This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in. I've got a couple great podcasts lined up for you this week. I'll be chatting this week with author Peter Schuck, who wrote the book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. Mr. Schuck is a returning guest on the program. He is a professor at Yale Law School and a very prolific author and very bright guy. We're glad to have him on the program. This week, I'll be talking about what China did last week in devaluing its currency and ask the question, are we seeing a repeat in a rather closely correlated sort of way as to what happened in the 1930s? Are we going to see currency wars and trade wars moving ahead? And is China just a little bit late to the dance when it comes to devaluing their currency? And most importantly, what will this mean for you and your money? So all that on this week's podcast. Quick reminder, if you'd like to get a copy of our Investor's Discovery Kit, it is free and it is yours by simply visiting the website, investingapproach.com. The website again is investingapproach.com. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program, Peter H. Schuck. He is the Simeon E. Baldwin Professor Emeritus of Law at Yale Law School, where he's held the chair since 1984. He's also served as Deputy Dean. His book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better, is available on Amazon. And Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dennis.
You know, there's some exciting things to talk about your book, too. You mentioned that the book is coming out in paperback. Do you want to give the listeners an update?
Yes. The book's done pretty well, and so the publisher is bringing it out in paperback in later this month. And it's gotten a lot of attention. I was on Jon Stewart, which was a lot of fun. This particularly mindful of that since his last show is going to be, I guess, on Thursday. So it's gotten some attention in that world as well.
Well, I would like to start by maybe having you explain to the listeners the premise of your book, Why Government Fails So Often. What motivated you to write the book?
Well, a few things. First of all, it's very dismaying for somebody who loves his country to see how disaffected our population has become with our federal government, with all governments, but especially with the federal government. Actually, our popular attitudes towards state and local governments are more positive than with Washington. And so I began by wondering why this is the case. And, you know, there are a couple of possibilities, and there are a lot of theories out there, but the one I thought deserved most attention was the hypothesis that government performs poorly. I mean, that's the most straightforward explanation. The population is dismayed about the government because it doesn't do what it's supposed to do very well. And so I thought about why that is. And I didn't want to just get bogged down in the political back and forth, but rather to look at the deeper reasons, the structural reasons that make this not just an occasional problem, but an endemic problem. Why is government so ineffective on so many levels? The book also discusses some of our successes, and there are some, but they're fewer and farther between than one might hope. I have a chapter on the successes and you know what we can learn from them as to why so many other programs fail. But that's the basic. That was the basic motivation for the book, which is to try to understand in a deep way why government fails as much as it does, and why this happens repeatedly. It's not simply a Republican administration or a Democratic administration, but in all administrations.
So, Peter, let's talk about some successes. Let's start out on a high note. Give us an example that you talk about in your book as to a success that the federal government has experienced.
Okay, well, there are a couple of them that occurred a long time ago, but they're still of great importance to us. One is the Homestead Act, which nourished the expansion west of our society, and another one was the Morrill Act, M-O-R-I-L-L, not M-O-R-A-L, which was passed. Both of these were enacted during the Lincoln administration. And the Morrill Act established the land-grant college system that so many people have benefited from and continue today. More modern times, the veterans, the GI Bill was, I think, by any measure, a great success. And even more recently than that, the airline deregulation, which was not a new program, but actually the elimination of an old program, a regulatory program, and then Social Security, which has eliminated most poverty among the elderly, and then the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is an excellent way of enabling the working poor to augment their incomes by creating a work incentive for them. So that the more they work, the more they earn, and the more the larger the subsidy they get from the federal government if they qualify for this Earned Income Tax Credit. And I'll just say parenthetically that many of us who want to see the working poor prosper are much more in favor of expanding the income tax credit than increasing the minimum wage, which I fear is going to reduce low-level jobs and increase the incentives for mechanization of those sorts of jobs.
Well, a lot of information there. If you're just joining us, we're chatting with Peter Schuck, who's the author of the book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. Peter, arguably, I want to go back. I'm glad, incidentally, that you brought up some modern-day successes. If we had to go all the way back to the Lincoln administration, I was going to be extremely depressed. Let's talk about Social Security, because arguably, I think according to the Social Security trustee report, the program is underfunded by between $17 and $8 trillion. Is that really a success?
I think it is a success, but not in terms of what you just said. That is to say, the program was a success and will continue to be a success if it's looming insolvency is addressed. And the good news is that there are lots of ways to do that are relatively palatable that I think the politicians will eventually come to. It's just that the longer they wait, the better it is for them and the worse it is for the policy, because the changes that are going to be necessary are going to have to be more more abrupt and cruder as we approach the date of potential insolvency. But, you know, there are lots of ways to do that. The government should have done it some time ago, and I have no doubt that it will be done. So I don't think Social Security is in any way an example of a failed policy. It's just it has to be updated, and it will be updated. I have no doubt about that. The knock on Social Security really is that some economists believe that Social Security has discouraged people from saving for their own retirement because of the knowledge that Social Security will be there for them. But I think as Social Security has become more worrisome in terms of its future solvency, young people today don't really count on Social Security being there, and I don't think it's affected their work incentives very much and their incentives to save.
Well, we are coming up on the end of this segment. We have about 45 seconds left, which might be just about enough time to share with the listeners what your next project is, Peter.
Well, I'm working on a book that I call Five Hard Issues and How to Think About Them. And this is intended for a general audience, people who are not specialists in these subjects but are very concerned about them and interested to know more about them. And the five are affirmative action, poverty, immigration, religious accommodation, and campaign finance. And so each of the book's going to have a chapter on each of those topics, which will, I think, educate curious citizens about, you know, what the fuss is all about.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. In this segment, I want to talk a bit about a topic that we revisit from time to time here on the program, and we do so in an attempt to educate our listeners. And it's interesting, this past week there was some stories that were actually printed in several newspapers. These stories were also on a number of news stations, radio news stations, radio talk shows. It had to do with the fact that China is devaluing its currency. And I want to take today's program and talk about that in some detail, because it reminds me of really what happened in the 1930s when world economies started to slow. And it's interesting how, as certain circumstances evolve and they look a lot like circumstances that existed at some point in the past, that the behavior of humans, in particular politicians and policymakers, is pretty predictable. Now, why do I want to talk about this on today's program? Well, the reason I do is that if we see what the outcome was when a certain policy was pursued at some past point, it's only logical, and history tells us, that if that same policy is pursued again, the outcome will again be similar. Now, here on the Everything Financial Radio program, we talk a lot about economic cycles. And economic cycles tend to repeat themselves over long periods of time because, again, the behavior of collective groups of humans tends to be predictable. We talk about the four economic seasons, and in the interest of time in this segment, I'll just preface my conversation here today by talking about the fact that we believe we are in an economic winter season. And like the winter season that we have every calendar year that follows an autumn season, the economic winter season also follows the economic autumn season. Now, in the interest of simplicity, during an economic autumn season, debt levels in the private sector rise to unsustainable levels. And this usually happens because of easy money policies. If you make it easy for people to borrow money, they borrow money. And when the capacity of the system to handle any more debt or service any more debt is reached, then the debt accumulation trend reverses and debt has to be purged from the system, which creates certain unpleasant economic conditions. And that's really the winter economic cycle. The winter economic cycle exists so that debt can be purged from the system. Well, one of the symptoms of the winter economic cycle is something called deflation. Technically defined, deflation is a contraction of the money supply. When that happens, you see prices of commodities fall. In fact, we're seeing that today in that the price of many base metals is falling. Oil this past week reached a six-year low. So deflation is a symptom of debt being purged from the system. Another symptom of this is economic contraction. Well, what does economic contraction mean? It means that a country just doesn't produce as many goods and services, and the bottom line is, and how that affects you and all our listeners, would be that there would be fewer jobs, lower trade between countries, and just less business. So everyone is ultimately affected. Now, policy responses. If you don't know what that means, that's just an action taken by a government. Often make things worse. A policy that's put in place that's intended to help often ends up having unintended consequences. And it's interesting when you study history how these policy responses tend to be very much the same in a certain economic circumstance, and the outcome tends to be very much the same and, in our view, very much predictable. Now, a common response to an economic winter season by a government is to attempt to increase trade. In other words, increase sales of the goods and services that your country produces to another country. I mean, it stands to reason that if you can't sell more in your country, it makes sense to try to sell more to others. And it's really important if you're a country over the long term to sell more than you buy or export more than you import. See, if you import more than you export, if you buy more than you sell, you have something known as a trade deficit. That's not good. And if you think about this in terms of cash flow in your household, it's really easy to understand. If you have more money coming in to your household, to your checkbook, than goes out, if there's more income than there are bills, you have a healthy economic situation. The same is true of countries. If you're selling more than you buy, you have a healthy economic situation. On the other hand, if you think about your household and you think about the fact that, wait a minute, I have more going out than is coming in, now you're actually burning through resources to make ends meet. The same is true when a country has a trade deficit. So when you have a winter economic season and you have economies slowing, you have economic contraction, you have governments that now try to put policies in place that will help sell more than they buy. It's that simple. And if you think about what happened back in the 1920s, and when Everything Financial Radio continues, I'll talk about some policy responses that are taking place now that are eerily similar to what we saw in the 20s, and I'll talk to you about what I believe the outcome will likely be. It's actually something that everyone really needs to pay attention to. But at the beginning of the Great Depression, you see that we all know from studying history that the economy tanks. The economy did tank, I should say. So in an attempt to try to fix this, an attempt to try to sell more, an attempt to try to pick up the economy, let's try to make the goods and services that we produce in our country, in this case the United States, more competitive. Well, how do you do that? Well, you can try to make your goods more competitive, or you can make foreign goods less competitive. And one of the ways that you can do that is to tax imports. If you slap a tax on imported goods, that's known as a tariff. And that makes imported goods less competitive. Well, back in June of 1930, at the beginning of the Great Depression, the economy had tanked. The economy was in the process of tanking. And an act called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was passed. And this raised tariffs or taxes on goods that were imported to historically high levels. Now, when you look at what historians' view would be of the Smoot-Hawley Act. Essentially, it really made the Great Depression worse. It didn't help. The idea was, let's make our goods more competitive, but ultimately that's not what happened. Now, ultimately, like happens when a lot of times laws are made, and I'll talk about this more when Everything Financial Radio continues, this was part of a campaign promise made by Herbert Hoover in the 1928 election. He was going to aid the American farmer by raising tariff levels on agricultural products. There was a significant level of overproduction in agriculture, but by the time the bill was passed, not only were agricultural products that were imported taxed or was there a tariff imposed, but special interest groups got a hold of Congress, and the bill raised tariffs not only on agricultural products, but products in all sectors of the economy. That led to a significant decline in trade, and this past week we saw something that looks very much similar to what we saw then. I'll talk about it more when Everything Financial Radio continues. Quick reminder, if you've not yet gotten a copy of your free Investor's Discovery Kit, I'd invite you to visit the website investingapproach.com and request your copy. The website, again, is investingapproach.com.